What's going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Primetime Sports Podcast, hosted by Joey May Lowry. So in today's episode, I'm going to do a big catch-up episode on a lot of transactions and signings happening in the MLB. I'll also talk about some trades from the NBA in the NFL head coaching carousel, with the New York Giants landing John Harbaugh as their head coach, which is a big pickup for them. So I'm going to give my thoughts on a lot of things that have happened over the last month. I've been meaning to do a catch-up episode, but haven't really found the time. So today I'm going to be able to do that. We'll start out with the NBA and some trades that have happened over the past few weeks. We'll start out with Trae Young. This trade was earlier in the new year. I think it was the first week of January. Trae Young was traded from the Atlanta Hawks to the Washington Wizards in exchange for CJ McCollum and Corey Crispett. Trae Young has 1 year left on his deal for the 26-27 season, which is a player option for $48.9 million. Trae Young leaves a legacy in Atlanta behind, a place where he's third all-time in points per game, first all-time in assists per game, and first in playoff points per game in the franchise's history. He's also third all-time in NBA history in assists per game, behind only Magic Johnson and John Stockton, which is very impressive. One thing that was going wrong for them this year was when Trae Young was in the lineup and he was healthy, for some reason, the Hawks just didn't play well. And I know Trae Young's not a great defensive player, and he didn't fit well in their lineup this year. I was a lot higher on Atlanta this season than most. It's been a disappointing year thus far. The Hawks were 2-8 in games where Trae Young played this season. Versus at the time of the trade, they were 16-13 without him, so they were a much better team without Trae Young. Now the Wizards land Trae Young. They have a nice young core of players. We'll see if Trae Young ends up picking up his player option for next season. I would imagine that will be the case considering Washington made this trade for a reason, probably expecting him to pick up that option. The Wizards, as I said, do have a nice young core of players. They have Trae Young, who's only 27 years old, Bilal Coulibaly, who I've not given up on, Alex Saar has really grown and sprouted this year, Keyshawn George has been very good for them, Bob Carrington has shown some flashes. They will be a problem in a few years. Just like I foreshadowed 2 years ago when the Detroit Pistons had the worst record at one point in the NBA and one of the worst all-time stretches in NBA history, I remember saying at that moment 2 years ago that the Detroit Pistons had a nice young core. They were going to figure things out and be better 2 years down the line. And here the Pistons are, the best team in the Eastern Conference. You look at this Washington Wizards team, they are struggling right now as we speak. But they do have a lot of talent, like I just mentioned. So I do think at some point, it won't be this season, but at some point in the future, this team will figure things out. They're 12-35 on the year, the worst record in the Eastern Conference, and tied for the second worst win percentage in the NBA. But I do think, give them a year or two, that team will figure things out at some point. Just like Detroit, they were at rock bottom and figured things out. I do think Washington will figure things out in a few years. They're really starting to build around a nice young core. Trae Young seems to really be enjoying his time at DC. So even though he's been hurt, he seems like he's been really enjoying his time on the bench and getting to know his teammates. And I know a lot of people gave him a lot of slack for saying his preferred trade destination was Washington. But it seems like he's happy there, and that's why I expect him to pick up his player option for next season. I know he hasn't played yet this year with those guys in Washington, but at some point he'll be back, and I do expect him to pick up his player option for next year. Young still has a quad injury, which has hurt him over the past month. He's been missing a lot of games for Washington and the Atlanta Hawks when he was still a member of the Hawks. He's going to be reevaluated after the All-Star break. Hopefully he is back sooner rather than later. As to the other side of this deal, the Atlanta Hawks pick up an expiring contract in CJ McCollum and a good three-point shooter in Corey Kispert. So this isn't a bad return for them. I am pretty shocked that they couldn't net a first-round pick back in return for Trae Young. But at the end of the day, Trae Young had a lot of leverage here in this situation, considering he does have a player option for next year, and the Atlanta Hawks did not want him to opt in and end up hurting their cap space for next year. So he really did have a lot of leverage in this situation, which at the end of the day did lessen the return that the Atlanta Hawks are going to get. I do think it's crazy, though, a player of Trae Young's caliber doesn't get a first-round pick in return, but obviously the financial implications of his deal and his injury history definitely played a role in Atlanta getting a lesser return in that trade there with Washington. Now moving on to another trade, and this is between the Cleveland Cavaliers, Sacramento Kings, and Chicago Bulls. In a three-team deal last night, DeAndre Hunter was traded from the Cleveland Cavaliers to the Sacramento Kings. The Kings acquired Dennis Schroeder in return, along with Keon Ellis from the Sacramento Kings, while also sending DeAndre Hunter to Sacramento. And the Chicago Bulls also were involved in this deal, landing Dario Saric and two future second-round picks. Schroeder was now traded for the eighth time in his career. That is the second most all time that a player has been traded in NBA history. Cleveland will now be his 11th franchise that he has suited up for. In this deal, the Cavs are adding a playmaking guard in Dennis Schroeder, who can score and give them some depth off the bench, while also adding an excellent defensive player in Keon Ellis, who is one of two NBA players this season, joining Asar Thompson to average 2.0 steals and 1.0 blocks per 36 minutes. Credit to ESPN for the stat. Also, there are financial implications in this deal. The Cavs are losing Hunter's contract, which will save them $44 million in luxury tax penalties for the season, bringing their luxury tax bill down from $164 million to $120 million. So that's $44 million they are saving. They were heavily in the second apron this year, which has made it nearly impossible for them to make some trades. I tried to build a trade package earlier this week for them to land LeBron James in a trade with the Los Angeles Lakers, but it was impossible considering they are in the second apron. So at the end of the day, if they do want to make a trade for a guy like LeBron James, they would have to add in a third team, and that probably played a role in them making this trade as well. The Cavs will be under the second apron now for next year, and that's the way things stand as of right now. Financial flexibility is definitely important for them. Ellis is on an expiring deal, while Schroeder still has 2 years left on his contract. For the Kings, they add a good 3-and-D player in DeAndre Hunter, who hasn't really played as well this season as he did last year, but I do think he can help that Sacramento Kings team since they do need more shooting. I wouldn't be surprised to see him be moved again in the future. I do expect the Sacramento Kings to have a fire sale this week, potentially trading DeMar DeRozan, Zach LaVine, Domantas Sabonis, Russell Westbrook, and Malik Monk. I think a lot of those players could be potentially moved in the coming days. I do like this trade for the Cavaliers, though, especially financially. Getting below the second apron now for next year is big time, and then you're also saving $44 million in luxury tax penalties for this season, and you're adding in a very good defense player in Keon Ellis, which that team could use, and a good scorer off the bench in Dennis Schroeder to run the second unit, which they're definitely missing what they had last year with Ty Jerome. Having Dennis Schroeder to be a scorer off the bench, I think, will help that team a lot for the rest of the season. Now moving on to MLB news. And we are going to talk about some signings and trades that have happened over the past month. We'll start out with Kyle Tucker, who signed a 4-year, $240 million contract with the LA Dodgers. He has opt-outs after year two and year three of that contract. He has a $64 million signing bonus with $30 million being deferred. He has a $57.1 million a year in net present value total after factoring in deferrals, and that's per Jeff Passan of ESPN. His $60 million AAV is 90% of the Miami Marlins' current payroll for the 2026 season, which is really crazy considering how much the Dodgers are spending. Keep in mind, the Dodgers did add Edwin Diaz at the start of free agency, who is the best reliever on the market, and now they're adding who I think was the best free agent on the open market, definitely remaining, and I think, honestly, maybe the best free agent heading into this offseason in Kyle Tucker. Tucker chose the Dodgers over the Mets, the Yankees, the Blue Jays, and others. It's important to note that the Dodgers are not doing anything wrong here. There are no rules against total spending or deferred compensation. There is a luxury tax, which the Dodgers are very fine going well above that each and every year and paying a big penalty. But it's gotten them two World Series rings in a row, and right now they're looking like the team that will probably three-peat heading into this season. Tucker chose the Dodgers, as I said, over the Mets, Yankees, Blue Jays, and others. You can't fault Kyle Tucker or any of these guys that have chose to go play in LA, like Blake Snell, like Shohei Ohtani, like Kyle Tucker, like Edwin Diaz. Players want to play in LA for the Dodgers. It's a big-time market. You play for a team that's dedicated to winning and contending for a championship. Year in and year out, they're always going to be a competitive team, and they are dedicated to winning. You cannot fault players wanting to go there. And like I said, there are no rules against total spending besides a luxury tax, and there's no rules against deferred compensation. So people can't really get mad at the Dodgers for what they're doing. It's not like they're breaking any rules. The Dodgers do have a lot of big-time contracts. They have 8 players under contracts over $100 million, and I'm going to break them down right now. Shohei Ohtani's on a 10-year, $700 million contract. Mookie Betts is on a 12-year, $365 million deal. Yoshinobu Yamamoto is on a 12-year, $325 million deal. Kyle Tucker's on a 4-year, $240 million deal. Blake Snell is on a 5-year, $182 million deal. Freddie Freeman's on a 6-year, $162 million deal. Will Smith is on a very cheap 10-year, $140 million deal. And Tyler Glasnow is on a 5-year, $136 million deal. Baseball will likely have a lockout after the season is over with, before the next collective bargaining agreement is determined next offseason. The Dodgers have a legitimate all-star lineup, all-star rotation, and an all-star bullpen. They are heavily paying in the luxury tax with a projected $161 million bill for the 2026 season in luxury tax penalties. The Dodgers' competitive balance tax payroll is $412 million, according to SpotTrack, for the 2026 season, which is around $170 million over the MLB's $244 million luxury tax threshold, pushing them to be beyond all four penalty tiers for the upcoming season, which those four penalty tiers, according to NewJersey.com, $244 million, $264 million, $284 million, and $304 million. Like I mentioned, the Dodgers are not necessarily doing anything wrong. What they're doing is spending heavily into the luxury tax, paying those luxury tax penalties, but giving them a chance to win each and every year and be in the World Series, which can't disregard that. Players do want to play in LA, like I mentioned, but the Dodgers do also want to win, so they're willing to do whatever it takes spending-wise to do that, and I give them respect for that. And not only do they sign a lot of big free agents, they're not afraid of making a big-time trade as they've done over the years, and they're also developing a very good farm system, including Mike Sirota, who I think is going to be the next MLB great from that Dodgers lineup. I expect Mike Sirota to be in the MLB lineup sometime late this year or early next season. I think by the end of this 2026 season, I do expect him to be very close to making it to the major leagues. And if he doesn't make it up this year, I do think he will make it up for the 2027 season. Sirota is a player I saw play a lot at Northeastern. He is my favorite prospect in the MLB. A guy that I've been high on since day one. I saw him play a lot of games at Northeastern over the years. I remember seeing him play one game in 2022, and after that one game, I thought he had the chance to be the next Mike Trout, because he is a very good player all around, defensively, offensively, can hit for power, hit for contact, has good speed around the bases, a good glove as well. He's a very smart player. I do expect the Dodgers to continue to develop his talent. He has a very unique skill set, and I think he's going to be a key player for them in the coming seasons. And I know that's really high praise and a very heavy expectation to say he can be the next Mike Trout, but I really did believe after seeing him play one game at Northeastern, I thought he was going to be the next Mike Trout. And ever since watching him play since day one, I've stayed supporting him and rooting for him each and every step of the way. So now to get back to Kyle Tucker really quick, he adds a ton of talent to an already loaded Dodgers lineup. He only had 22 home runs last year. He did miss some games with an injury. Hit .266 for a batting average, 73 RBIs, and an .841 OPS for the Cubs. He's never had a 30-30 season, but I predict he will have one this season. Then you look at the Dodgers' talent, not only in their starting lineup, but in their rotation. This team is an all-star lineup all around. Their starting rotation is ridiculous. You got Yamamoto, Snell, Ohtani, Glasnow, and Roki Sasaki. And then you're adding in other potential quality starters in Bobby Miller, Emmett Sheehan, and Gavin Stone. This team is just absolutely loaded and stacked. I'm excited to watch that Dodgers team play this season. Now moving on to Bo Bichette, who signed a three-year, $126 million deal with the New York Mets, $42 million a year, which I think is an overpay. He's a good player. I don't think he's worth $42 million a year, but I know it's a short-term deal with opt-outs after the 2026 season and 2027 season, which gave Bichette obviously a high AAV to potentially have a really good year and then get a bigger contract next offseason, maybe similar to what Alex Bregman did this year, signed a three-year deal with the Red Sox at a high AAV, $40 million a year, and then Bregman ends up opting out after year one and then getting a big-time free agent contract from the Chicago Cubs, which Bregman ended up getting a five-year, $175 million deal with the Cubs this offseason. We'll see what Bichette gets next offseason. I do expect him to opt out after one year with the Mets. The plan is for Bichette to be a third baseman for them next year while keeping Francisco Lindor as a starting shortstop. Like I mentioned, he does have opt-outs after the next two seasons, which I do expect him to opt out. I do think he was looking for financial flexibility where you have the opt-out potential while also receiving a high AAV. He didn't really have the best year last year. Batting average-wise was a big bounce-back season. .311 batting average and a 94 RBI total with an .840 OPS. Didn't hit that many home runs last year, though. Just 18 home runs in 139 games. But he did have a bounce-back year batting average-wise. It was a very good hitter with runners in scoring position. 94 RBIs is very impressive and definitely will help that Mets lineup, which it's going to be a very new-look Mets team with Pete Alonso gone, Jeff McNeil gone, Brandon Nimmo gone, Edwin Diaz all gone. They did bring in Bo Bichette. They did sign Luke Weaver. They did sign Devin Williams. They did trade for Marcus Semien, who I think is a very talented player, but I think his best baseball is well behind him. They did just trade for Luis Robert as well from the Chicago White Sox. He had just 14 home runs in each of the last two seasons while missing 50-plus games in each of those 2 years. But if you look at 2023 when he was healthy, he had 38 home runs with 80 RBIs. So it's a big-time power bat potential there added to the Mets lineup if he can stay healthy. I know the Mets had a lot of fan favorites depart this offseason, with Alonso being the favorite. But I think this team did bounce back from losing Alonso, McNeil, Diaz, and Nimmo with a good offseason, adding in Bo Bichette, adding in Luis Robert, adding in Luke Weaver, adding in Devin Williams, and then also trading for Freddy Peralta. I do think this team had a good bounce back from losing the players that they did this offseason. And they chose to let a lot of those players leave. Pete Alonso and the Mets couldn't find a deal to make things work on a long-term contract. Edwin Diaz left in free agency as well. They did choose to trade Brandon Nimmo. So a lot of these players have departed in different ways, some in free agency, some via trade. But I do think the Mets bounced back with a good offseason. I think they've had a better offseason than people are giving them credit for. I do think that team will be competitive next year. They did make a big-time trade, trading for Freddy Peralta. They received Freddy Peralta and right-handed pitcher Tobias Mias from the Brewers in exchange for infielder Jett Williams, who is now the Brewers' number three prospect, and right-hander Brandon Sproat, who is now their sixth best prospect in the Brewers' farm system. Jett Williams is a minor league second baseman who is undersized at just 5'7", but he has a ton of upside speed, which has led to success stealing bases and tallying doubles in the minors. In 4 years in the minor leagues, he's hitting just .256, but has 31 home runs, 117 RBIs, 90 stolen bases in 109 attempts, with 65 doubles and 17 triples. As for Brandon Sproat, he's pitched in 4 MLB games in 2025 with a 4.79 ERA and a 2.8 FIP. Freddy Peralta, going back to the Mets in this deal, is just 29 years old, led the NL in wins this past year with 17. He had 17 wins, 6 losses, 2.70 ERA and 33 starts for the Brewers with a 3.64 FIP and 10.4 strikeouts per 9 innings. He amassed 200-plus strikeouts in 3 straight seasons. And then they also add in Tobias Mias in this deal, who I think doesn't really necessarily have elite metrics on Baseball Savant, but I think he can be a good depth piece for that bullpen there, or even in the back end of the starting rotation for the Mets. Mias had a 1-2 record this past year in 22 appearances, making 6 starts for the Brewers with the 3.55 ERA. I do like this deal a lot for the Mets. I think this is a win for the Mets. And as for the Brewers, we'll have to see how things work out with Sproat and Williams. But I would consider this right now a win for the New York Mets. I do think the Brewers, though, continue to develop really good players and then end up trading them for young pieces. We saw that with Corbin Burnes being a player they traded a few years ago and now trading Freddy Peralta as well. They continue to develop good talent and then trade those players as time goes on. But as of right now, I'll grade this trade as a win for the Mets. And it's really a question mark as of now for the Brewers, which I guess every trade is always a question mark because you never know how a player is going to perform in a new place, especially a young prospect like Williams, like Sproat. But I do think, as of right now, this Mets team, adding Freddy Peralta to that rotation, I would consider that a very big win for them. Now moving on to another free agency deal, and that is Alex Bregman. He signed a 5-year, $175 million deal with the Chicago Cubs, also receiving a full no-trade clause in that deal, which the Red Sox were not willing to give Bregman a full no-trade clause, which ended up being the difference between him staying in Boston and leaving. Now the Red Sox have a void at third base, which could be filled by Marcelo Meyer if he stays healthy. I think the Sox could go after a guy like Eugenio Suarez, who is a big-time swing-and-miss guy but has a ton of power, hit 49 home runs this past season with a .228 batting average and an .824 OPS. He did strike out 196 times in 2025, so that will be tough to add that to a lineup, a big strikeout guy, which the Red Sox already have a lot of big swing-and-miss guys, Seydon Rafaela being one of them. But I do think when you can add in a big power bat like Eugenio Suarez, I think that would be a good add for the Red Sox. Bregman will now have $70 million deferred between 2034 and 2041 in this deal with the Cubs. Bregman hit 18 home runs this past year for the Red Sox with a .273 batting average, 62 RBIs, an .821 OPS, and a .128 OPS plus in 114 games for the Sox. His time in Boston was short, but an event-filled year for sure. Bregman's signing did cause a rift with Rafael Devers, which led to the Red Sox shipping out Devers in a trade with the Giants. Now both players are gone, so this deal ends up costing the Red Sox not only Alex Bregman leaves in free agency, but you lost your star in Rafael Devers, which honestly probably was the best deal for the Red Sox at the time, was moving on from Devers. I do think if they realized that Bregman is going to leave in free agency, maybe things would have been different, but the Red Sox had their chances and their time in free agency to get a deal done with Bregman, and even during the season as well, they were never able to come to a conclusion that worked for both sides, and now Bregman will be moving on to the Chicago Cubs. He seemed like a very good veteran in that Red Sox locker room. We'll see who ends up stepping up for the Sox, considering they lost Bregman, they lost Rob Resnider, two guys that are very well respected in the clubhouse. We'll see what they end up looking like this season and who will be that veteran leader for that locker room. Staying on topic of the Red Sox, they did make a free agent signing a five-year, $130 million deal with left-handed pitcher Ranger Suarez. He's getting $26 million a year. It's a heavily backloaded deal, with Suarez receiving $7.6 million from the Red Sox on their payroll in 2026, but he's getting up to $35.6 million in the last year of the deal in 2030. He had a 12-8 record, 12 wins, 8 losses, a 3.20 ERA, and a 3.21 FIP in 2025 for the Phillies. Over the last 5 seasons, Suarez compiled a 46-34 record in 143 appearances, making 116 starts, with a 3.44 FIP, a 3.25 ERA, which his ERA and his FIP continuously seem to be very even. He had a 129 ERA plus and averaged 8.4 strikeouts per 9 innings. Suarez will now be the number 2 player in the Red Sox rotation, which is one of the top pitching rotations in baseball. You have Garrett Crochet, Ranger Suarez, so that's back-to-back left-handed pitches, Sonny Gray, Brian Bello, and then Johan Oviedo, who the Red Sox traded for this year with the Pittsburgh Pirates in the offseason. He had a 2-1 record last year in 9 starts, with 3.57 as his ERA, a 4.92 FIP, and 9.4 strikeouts per 9 innings. He did have Tommy John surgery in 2023 and then a lat injury in spring training in 2025, which cost him some of this season, but he did have some decent numbers, a 3.57 ERA. If he's your number 5 starter, I think that's very good. You're also adding in Cutter Crawford, who missed all of 2025, but he could return as a key contributor for that Red Sox starting rotation. The Red Sox finally reallocated some of the money they saved from trading Rafael Devers by adding Suarez. This Red Sox team still needs a power bat, maybe Eugenio Suarez or Marcell Ozuna. I think Ozuna would be a cheap contract and maybe be a good DH in that lineup to be a big-time power bat for that Red Sox team. He also could play the field as well if you want to keep Masataka Yoshida as a DH. You have the option of having Ozuna play the outfield as well. And the same thing goes for Yoshida. He could play the outfield maybe a little bit more as well this season. So now for the last deal I'm going to talk about in the MLB, that is Cody Bellinger re-signing with the Yankees on a five-year, $162.5 million deal. That's $32.5 million a year that the Yankees signed Bellinger to. He has a full no-trade clause and has opt-outs after the 2027 season and the 2028 season. The Yankees could not afford to lose Bellinger after missing out on Kyle Tucker in free agency and also missing out on Bo Bichette. They had to find a way to get Bellinger back in a Yankees uniform. I do think that's a heavy payday. I don't know if that was the best deal for the Yankees money-wise. $32.5 million over 5 years for Bellinger, I do think is a lot. We'll see how that ends up playing out. If he stays healthy, the first 2 or 3 years of that deal could be very productive. He had a very productive season for the Yankees this past year. 29 home runs, 98 RBIs, with .272 as his batting average, and an .814 OPS. Considering the talent and the power that the Orioles added this offseason, with Pete Alonso and Taylor Ward going to the Orioles, the Yankees could not let Bellinger leave. There was a lot of moves made this offseason in that division. The Yankees had to get Bellinger back in a Yankees uniform. With that being said, this is a big-time payday for him and isn't overpaying, in my opinion, but that's a reality of the market. If you want to get a player and keep them, you have to give them a big-time payday and probably overspend in this free agency market. So now I'm going to shift over to the NFL. I'm going to talk about John Harbaugh going to the New York Giants as their next head coach. Harbaugh is a very well-respected coach in the NFL. He brings a culture and a stability that the New York Giants need. It's been a revolving door for the Giants ever since Tom Coughlin and the Giants parted ways. The Giants have had a continuous revolving door at the head coaching position. The Giants have made the playoffs just 2 times since Tom Coughlin and the Giants parted ways. They have a 55-109-1 record over the last decade and 4 head coaches, and that's all since Coughlin left. They've had Ben McAdoo as a head coach, Pat Shermer as a head coach, Joe Judge as a head coach, and Brian Daboll as a head coach. All of them overall were tough eras for the Giants, despite some bright spots in each era, like an 11-win season in year 1 for McAdoo, Daniel Jones' excellence as a rookie in Pat Shermer's second year with the New York Giants in 2019, Joe Judge's introductory speech, which cultivated the fan base at the time, really got the Giants to really buy back in to the hard-nosed football culture, which ended up being a miss for the Giants. And then you look at the Brian Daboll era, making the playoffs in year 1 and winning a playoff game on the road. There were some bright spots in each of those 4 eras, but overall, they were misses when you look at it. And since the Giants lost Coughlin, things just haven't really gone their way. So you go out and you get a very stable head coach in John Harbaugh, who compiles 193 wins between the regular season and the playoffs in 18 seasons in Baltimore, winning Super Bowl 47 in 2013. He only had three seasons under 500 in 18 years, which is very crazy. That's a ridiculous stat. Only three seasons with a record under 500. When you look at the Giants, they have lost 10-plus games in eight of the last 10 seasons. And like I mentioned, the Giants have a 55-109-1 record over the last 10 seasons, which is the second worst in the NFL over the last decade, only better than the New York Jets, while Harbaugh, in 18 seasons in Baltimore, only had 113 losses. So the Giants have had 109 losses over the last 10 seasons, while Harbaugh only lost 113 games in 18 years in Baltimore. So you're bringing in a winning culture and a very well-respected head coach. I think this was the best head coaching hire of any of them this offseason. I think this was the best get. And the New York Giants, they needed that. As I said, they needed a guy that brought a culture and brought stability. And the Giants got just that with John Harbaugh. And now another head coaching hire I want to talk about is Kevin Stefanski to the Atlanta Falcons. In 6 years with the Cleveland Browns, Stefanski had a 45-56 record with a 1-2 record in the playoffs. I think, honestly, that record, 45-56, is very impressive considering Stefanski had no consistent quarterback play when he was with the Browns. Baker Mayfield showed a lot of promise, but they gave up on him early. Deshaun Watson was a complete miss of a trade in a big-time contract. And they had some starts from Joe Flacco, Dorian Thompson-Robinson, Jameis Winston, Dylan Gabriel, and Shador Sanders, to name a few. So they never really had a stable quarterback in his time in Cleveland. They were in a tough spot because of Deshaun Watson's horrific contract. I think if you look at the last two seasons, they were 8-26 over the last 2 years. So the Browns wanted to go out and get a new head coach. But I don't think Stefanski was the issue in Cleveland. I do think this is a very good hire for the Atlanta Falcons. If Michael Penix Jr. can live up to his expectations that I had for him, and if he can take a step up heading into this next year, I think this team can be a very dangerous team in 2026. Especially considering the NFC South was a very weak division in the 2025 season. So now moving on to another head coaching hire, and that was the Pittsburgh Steelers hiring Mike McCarthy as their next head coach. He grew up a Steelers fan. He wins a lot of ball games and always had a competitive team. So I don't think this is a bad hire like people like to make it seem. Mike Tomlin stepping down was definitely a surprise to me. In 19 seasons as a Steelers head coach, Tomlin had a 193-114-2 record with an 8-12 playoff record and one Super Bowl victory. I think the most impressive thing was that he never had a season below a 500 record, which is very impressive. Even in years where key players got hurt, even at the quarterback position, the Steelers were always competing for a playoff spot. He had a 10-7 record in three straight seasons. He made the playoffs in 13 of 19 years, which is very, very impressive. He's a very well-respected head coach who is technically still under contract. So if another team does want Mike Tomlin as their head coach, they would have to make a trade with the Steelers for him. I think the Steelers and Mike Tomlin decided to mutually part ways because I think they just didn't want to get complacent with just making the playoffs and having seasons over 500. They want to have a chance to win another Super Bowl, and it's a very well-respected franchise, a historic franchise. You expect that team to always be competitive, which they were under Mike Tomlin. I give him credit for that, but I think they wanted more playoff success, and they didn't really have that in recent seasons. So I think that's why they ended up moving on and mutually parting ways. Even though the report was that Mike Tomlin decided to step down, I think it was more so that they kind of just both agreed to kind of split ways and go in different directions. I think the Mike McCarthy hire is a little bit better than people are giving the Steelers credit for. I think when you look at Mike McCarthy, a guy that obviously has a lot of experience, 18 seasons as NFL head coach, just like John Harbaugh, they have very similar win percentages. Harbaugh had a 620 win percentage. Mike McCarthy has a 619 win percentage. I think when you look at it, they each have won Super Bowl. They each are always competitive, it seems like, each and every year, and have had playoff success over their careers, even if it wasn't in recent seasons. So I do think this hire isn't that bad of a hire for the Steelers. And Mike McCarthy did grow up a Steelers fan, which is a very cool story. I don't think this is that bad of a hire for them. I know he doesn't have the recent playoff success, and a lot of the time in Green Bay and even in Dallas, they should have been better than they were in the playoffs. But when you're looking at getting a guy that always has a competitive team in the regular season and gives himself a chance to win in the playoffs, Mike McCarthy isn't a bad pickup in that regard. I know he could be better in the playoffs, and that's definitely the truth, especially in Dallas. There were higher expectations each and every year for them to take that next step up, and they never did. But I think when you're losing a legendary coach like Mike Tomlin, getting a competent coach in Mike McCarthy, who has won a lot of ball games in the NFL, I think that is a good pickup. And now moving on to the last thing I want to talk about, and this is about the Pro Bowl, which is going to take place this Tuesday on ESPN. There will be a flag football game at 8 p.m. this coming Tuesday. But a big question mark over the last week or two is, should the NFL discontinue the Pro Bowl? And if you look at what the NFL did over the last few years, in 2023, the NFL decided to shift from the Pro Bowl into the Pro Bowl games, where you're no longer playing a football game in full pads, where they're basically just playing two in touch. You shift to playing a flag football game, and you have all these different types of competitions, like a dodgeball game. You have kick-tack-toe, which was a Pro Bowl game, essentially, where there would be kickers, and they would play tic-tac-toe, kicking field goals in between different quadrants, between the uprights. The NFL shifted from essentially a two-hand touch game into the Pro Bowl games over the last few years, which for the last few years, I've watched the Pro Bowl games and I've actually enjoyed watching some of the competitions they've done. So I'm not completely against the event. With that being said, the fact that most star players would rather skip the event more and more now than even in years past, leading to fourth and fifth place alternates being named a Pro Bowler, I think that's an issue because I think it takes away the value of being named a Pro Bowler when you have Joe Flacco and Shedeur Sanders being named Pro Bowl alternate quarterbacks this year for the AFC. As much as I've been rooting for Shedeur Sanders over the last few months due to all the criticism he gets, I don't think he should be named a Pro Bowler. I think it takes away from the value of being named a Pro Bowler when Shedeur Sanders was in the bottom of many quarterback statistics from the 2025 NFL season. He totaled 1,400 passing yards, which was 35th in the NFL. He had a 56.6% completion percentage, which was 42nd in the NFL. He had a 4.7% interception percentage, which was 41st in the NFL. He had a 68.1 passer rating, which was 41st in the NFL. He had an 18.9 quarterback rating, which was 40th in the NFL. So there were a lot of categories where Shedeur Sanders was very much below what should be Pro Bowl caliber statistics. He totaled 8 touchdowns on the year with 10 total turnovers, which I know he didn't play in many games, right? They started some games with Joe Flacco. They started some games with Dylan Gabriel. So it wasn't like he played the entire season, but that is not a good touchdown to turnover ratio. That shouldn't be a Pro Bowl selection. His passer rating this year, which, as I mentioned, was 41st in the NFL with a 68.1 passer rating. That is the 15th all-time lowest for a quarterback rating by a player to be named to the Pro Bowl roster in the Super Bowl era. Also adding in, he was 42nd out of 43 eligible quarterbacks on Pro Football Network this season. His 68.1 passer rating was the lowest in football among quarterbacks in 2025 that threw 200 plus passes. He also had the fifth worst QBR since QBR became a stat in 2006, and the worst of any quarterback in a Browns single season for quarterback that started 6-plus games. There's definitely a chance that guys like Trevor Lawrence, CJ Stroud, Aaron Rodgers all declined invites. Maybe Cam Ward declined an invite as well, which I don't know why he would. He's young, and I think it would be good for marketing purposes for him to go there, especially as the reigning number one overall pick. I think it would be a good thing for him to be there. Who knows if he got an alternate option to be invited. He could have been a Pro Bowl alternate. Maybe he declined it. I do see a very high chance that a guy like Aaron Rodgers declines it, especially at his age. But the fact that Joe Flacco and Shedeur Sanders end up making the Pro Bowl in a year where neither one really had that great of a year statistically, I think that brings down the value of even former players that were named to Pro Bowls 10, 15 years ago. I think that brings down the value, especially when you have a guy like Tyler Huntley, who was a backup quarterback a few years ago and started some games and Lamar Jackson was hurt. When he made the Pro Bowl, that was a big question mark. And now it's just happening even more and more. And the fact that less players want to participate in it and they'd rather not play and not even be involved in the Pro Bowl, I think that's just showing that it probably should be discontinued. And Shedeur Sanders making the Pro Bowl is no doubt a good marketing tactic for the league, since people will tune in to see how he does, and I'd definitely be tuning in and I'll be rooting for him to do well on Tuesday night. But the fact that that many players are declining invites to the Pro Bowl and you're getting to the fifth and sixth alternates and they're making Pro Bowls, especially Joe Flacco, in what maybe could be his last year in the NFL, he's making the Pro Bowl for the first time in his career. I think that brings down the value of making the Pro Bowl, and I think at some point the NFL is going to have to really look hard at potentially discontinuing it. And I know they want to get ratings up. In the first year of the flag football Pro Bowl, which we can call the Pro Bowl games, they had 6.2 million viewers. Then in 2024, that number declined to 5.75 million viewers. And then last year in 2025, they had 4.7 million viewers for the flag football finale, which was an 18% drop from the previous season. In this year's Pro Bowl, it will be coached by Steve Young and Jerry Rice, which in years past, it was Eli Manning and Peyton Manning coaching in the Pro Bowl games. Now they'll be shifting to Jerry Rice and Steve Young. The Pro Bowl games this year will take place in the San Francisco Bay Area, with the Super Bowl taking place in Santa Clara. They'll be shifting to going to two former 49er legends and Pro Football Hall of Famers, Jerry Rice and Steve Young, to be the head coaches in the 2026 Pro Bowl games. I enjoyed watching Eli Manning and Peyton Manning coach against each other. I thought the Pro Bowl games, honestly, the last few years were fun. But I think when you get into the sixth alternate, or whatever it ended up being, which no one really knows if Trevor Lawrence and Aaron Rodgers declined invites, but it's presumed that both of those guys did. I think if you're getting to like the sixth alternate, Joe Flacco and Shedeur Sanders are making it in a year where Shedeur Sanders had 8 total touchdowns and 10 turnovers, and Joe Flacco had 15 touchdowns to 10 picks. I just don't think it's a great look when you have those guys making the Pro Bowl, especially when you have a guy like Andrew Thomas on the Giants, who very well could have been a Pro Bowl selection for the Giants. But since it is basically a popularity contest because it's a fan vote, you end up, I think, taking away from the value of being named a Pro Bowl selection. And that's with me rooting for Shedeur Sanders. I like Shedeur a lot. I wish him all the best, and I hope he ends up being a very successful quarterback for the Browns. But I don't think with 8 total touchdowns and 10 turnovers this year, and as bad of a passer rating and a quarterback rating he had, I don't think he should be a Pro Bowl selection. I think if that many players are declining a Pro Bowl invitation, I think that just shows that the NFL has to really pivot, and maybe you still name a Pro Bowl roster, but you don't end up playing the games. There are probably a lot of revenue streams that the NFL will make from this, having it on ESPN. They probably get commercial money. There's probably sponsorship money as well. And I think the NFL will continue to do that as long as they are making money on the Pro Bowl games. I think they will continue to do this, even with all of the negative criticism from fans and the media. If the NFL is making money off of it, I think they will continue to endorse the Pro Bowl and continue to try to make ways for it to be popular again. I just think with the current format, even though I enjoyed it the last few years and I will still tune in on Tuesday night, I do think you're going to lose more and more fans as years go on, considering the fact that more and more star players are opting out of it and would rather not be participating. I think that's just a tough look for the Pro Bowl and the future of it. With that being said, some players have injuries. Josh Allen is hurt. Bo Nix is hurt. Daniel Jones is hurt. Patrick Mahomes is hurt. Justin Herbert's hurt. So there's a lot of injuries, and that's why you get far down on the reserves list to get alternates. With that being said, I am happy for Shedeur. I do think the NFL knows this will help get the ratings up. People are going to want to watch Shedeur Sanders. I'm definitely tuning in to watch Shedeur Sanders, like I already noted. That's going to get the ratings up. Shedeur does bring a lot of attention with them. There are people that are going to tune in to root for him, like I am. And then there will be people that are going to root against him, and they'll tune in for that. So there will be a lot of people tuning in to see him play. And I do think it's a good thing for Shedeur, though. I'm happy that he made the Pro Bowl, and I'll definitely be rooting for him and hoping that he does great in that game. But like I mentioned, I do think the Pro Bowl has declined over the last decade or so, and I do think at some point the NFL is going to have to at least question maybe just naming a Pro Bowl roster and then not playing the Pro Bowl games. With all that being said, I do enjoy watching. Like I said, I've watched the last few years of the Pro Bowl games, and I'll be watching the flag football game on Tuesday night. But I do know it is an afterthought for most fans, and a lot of people see it as a declining product. But Shedeur being in the Pro Bowl is a testament to the aura he brings. I think people want to tune in to see him. He's going to be smiling. He's going to be having fun. I think that's something that fans are attracted to. Also, you're going to sell some more jerseys and t-shirts that are Shedeur Sanders Pro Bowl shirts. You'll have more people tuning in, like I mentioned. I do wish him all the best on Tuesday night. I will be watching. I do think Shedeur Sanders, even though he did struggle this year, and I know he led the league in interceptions. I think he had 10 interceptions since his debut in Week 11. I know he led the league since that Week 11 point. With that being said, he's young. Rookies are going to struggle. We'll see how he looks in year two. Drake May struggled at points in year one for the Patriots. He had 15 touchdowns and 10 picks, I think, in his rookie year. And then year two, doubled the touchdowns, had 31, and had 2 less interceptions with 8 total interceptions on the year. So it's possible Shedeur Sanders bounces back and has a really good year two. I think a lot of people are too critical of Shedeur. He's very young. He's on a team that's struggled to really find a franchise quarterback for basically the history of the Cleveland Browns. It's not really an easy place to try to succeed, especially in year one when you're stepping in midway through the season. We'll see how he bounces back in year two. I will be rooting for him next year, and I'll be rooting for him on Tuesday night. As I said, I'm happy for Shador. I do think it's good for him to be in the Pro Bowl games. He's going to gain some fans from it, I do think. I think when he's there and he's having a fun time and he's going to be smiling and if he has a couple great plays, I think people will be buying into Shador more and be more of a fan of him. Anyways, that'll wrap up this episode. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to listen to this. As always, I appreciate it. I hope you guys have a great rest of your day, and I hope to catch you in the next episode. Thank you.